You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Resident Evil by Michael Shulman. In a sense, Fletcher had been preparing to play Nurse Ratched all her life. She grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, the second child of deaf parents. Her father, an Episcopal missionary, had 42 missions in 11 states. On Sundays, he led services for deaf African Americans. Having deaf parents, Fletcher explains, is like having immigrant parents. You feel a special responsibility, and you're a translator. You try to explain the world and how it works to them. Her mother was a movie lover, and every weekend at the cinema, Fletcher would clarify the plots in sign language. People used to tease me and say that's how I got started, redoing old Betty Davis movies. The young Fletcher would dance and sing for her aunt's bridge club, and at 11 she decided to be an actress. She studied theater at the University of North Carolina, and in 1957 moved to Los Angeles with two roommates. There she met her husband, the producer Jerry Bick, and acted in bit parts on TV series like Maverick and Perry Mason. In the early 60s, she gave birth to two sons and decided to give it all up. I had absolutely no intention of ever going back. By 1973, the family was living in London, and Bick was producing movies for Robert Altman. Bick asked his wife to take a role in Altman's Thieves Like Us. I said, "No, I'm not doing it. I'm not being in my husband's movie," Fletcher recalls. "I'm not having those other actors look at me and say, 'I know how you got this movie.'" Well, he didn't cast it. He more or less just dared me not to do it. After a decade, she was back in the game. Fletcher's parents visited the Mississippi set, and Altman watched her translate sign language for her husband. It gave him an idea for a character for a future project, and Fletcher began meeting with the screenwriter Joan Tewksbury. Fletcher assumed she would play the character they were developing, but months later, she was on the phone with Altman's wife, Catherine, who mentioned that Lily Tomlin had joined the cast. "Who's she going to play?" Fletcher asked. "Oh, my God, Louise, I shouldn't have said anything," Catherine replied. That's how Fletcher found out she wasn't going to star in Nashville. Out of a job and furious with Altman, she began pursuing another project, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Foreman had seen her in Thieves Like Us. He was thinking of her co-star Shelley Duvall for one of McMurphy's floozy girlfriends. Every few weeks, he and Fletcher met at the Sunset Marquee to discuss Nurse Ratched, though she was unaware of the other actresses turning him down. She knew that Kesey's version was unplayable because she's got smoke coming out of her ears. But she had a solution. Her chief insight? Nurse Ratched is convinced she's right. Fletcher had spent much of 1974 consumed with the unfolding Watergate scandal, even writing letters to senators, and saw elements of Nixon in the big nurse's perversion of power. She thought back to her childhood in Alabama and the paternalistic way that people treat other people there. Moving to California had opened her eyes to how warped things had been back home. White people actually felt that the life they were creating was good for black people, she says, a dynamic she recognized in Nurse Ratched and her charges. They're in this ward. She's looking out for them, and they have to act like they're happy to get this medication or listen to this music and make her feel good about the way she is. Like Fletcher, Foreman had lived under an oppressive system. I slowly started to realize that it will be much more powerful if it's not this visible evil, he said in a 1997 interview, that she's only an instrument of evil. She doesn't know that she's evil. She, as a matter of fact, believes that she's helping people. On December 26, 1974, Fletcher got a call from her agent. She was due in Salem, Oregon, on January 3rd. Dr. Dean Brooks had read Kesey's novel in 1962 and hated it. He thought it totally misrepresented Oregon State Hospital, where he happened to be superintendent. But by the time Michael Douglas came scouting for locations, Brooks had begun to realize that the story was an allegory about the use and misuse of power. Also, he figured, if the filmmakers used a soundstage, they'd get it all wrong. As a bonus, Foreman gave him a part in the movie. What the director wanted was realism. His mantra was, "Is it natural?" Before a frame was shot, the cast spent 2 weeks in the ward, observing patients and sitting in on group therapy. Each actor got a private cell with a cubby where he could keep a toothbrush and some personal effects. "I would go up to the maximum security level on the third floor," recalls Christopher Lloyd, "and there was a guy, a young guy, a wonderful cartoonist, really talented. He was up there because he killed his girlfriend or something like that." It was rather striking how normal everybody appeared, particularly in maximum security, says Brad Dourif, who played Billy Bibbit. At one group therapy session, mixed in among real patients, he noticed something about the head nurse. "I had the feeling that she felt everybody should be more like her, that she was the normal one. I remember saying that to Louise as we walked away, asking if she got the same impression, and she said, 'You're really onto something there.'" Before Oregon, Fletcher had met with the celebrity hairdresser, Carrie White, who came up with Nurse Ratched's signature page boy. Fletcher wanted a hairstyle that looked stuck in time, as if she hadn't bothered to change it since World War II. Since the character is never seen outside of work, it was up to Fletcher to fill out her life beyond the hospital grounds. She concocted a detailed backstory, but to this day keeps it a secret. "Ryan Murphy has not been in touch," she says. This much she will reveal. She had sacrificed her life for other people. She hasn't married, hadn't done this, hadn't done that, and was self-sufficient on her own, leading this life, because she dedicated her life, her earlier life, to other people who needed her. Also, she decided that Nurse Ratched was a 40-year-old virgin and was very turned on by this McMurphy guy. Fletcher was confident she had a grip on the character until her first day of shooting. "We started with the scene where McMurphy first comes in, and I tell him, 'If you do this, do that, play by the rules, everything will be just fine,'" she recalls. "I greet him like you would, kind, soft-spoken, and apparently I tilted my head, as you do. So Milos came up after the first take and he said, 'Don't tilt your head, it's weak.'" Suddenly, all she could think about was not tilting her head. That night, she called her husband and told him, "I'm going to get fired from this job. You just watch. I can't do it. I'm in a vice now, and I can't move my head." Even Nicholson could tell something was off and reassured her, "Oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about." The discrepancy, in essence, was how Fletcher and Foreman saw Nurse Ratched's strength. For Fletcher, the key was to make her seem pleasant, delivering her lines so placidly that at one point she asked a sound guy if she was audible. But Freeman worried. Could a gentle-voiced Nurse Ratched hold her own against Nicholson's off-the-wall McMurphy? He was scared that that was a weakness, and I was going to look weak and sound weak, Fletcher says. After a couple of days, Foreman realized his error and told her, I made a mistake. They went back and reshot the first scene Fletcher's way. As the shoot went on, reality and fiction started to blur together. You began to perceive that the line between being sane and being crazy is thinner than you think, Dourif says. Sidney Lassick, who played Cheswick, would tap dance in the hallways. Danny DeVito, who had left his then-girlfriend, Ray Perlman, behind in New York, had an imaginary friend. I had somebody with me all the time, he says now. Fletcher, meanwhile, found herself gently instructing her castmates at lunch. Come on now, eat up. Adding to the madness, there were actual patients assisting with set direction and props. We had somebody working in the art department who was an arsonist, says Douglas. I said, is this really a good idea? Angelica Houston, Nicholson's girlfriend at the time, visited the set and recalls. At one point, some grip was opening a window that had a grill behind it in order to put through some cable, and one of the patients who had a very low-level clearance jumped out the window. They stopped him, but he was pretty intent on throwing himself out three stories. For breaks, the cast and crew had a game room where they could play billiards and the video game Pong. At night, they'd go drinking in Salem. Will Sampson, who turned out to be quite the party animal, would return to the motel with multiple waitresses and show up to work the next morning with bloodshot eyes. Fletcher instinctually knew that she had to distance herself from the camaraderie. I thought, I can't do this, she says. I can't be in this motel and be with these guys. It's too much fun. But she was scared to broach the subject with the producers. This is the first time I've told this story, she tells me, leaning in. I never thought they'd give me what I wanted. I didn't have faith that if I went to them and said living with these guys is going to kill my performance, so you've got to move me somewhere where I can be on my own. Why didn't I trust them to do the right thing, to give me what I wanted? So I said I got threatening phone calls. I made up a story. Michael Douglas didn't remember the cover story, but said, I do remember her loneliness, the fact of having to keep one step away. Fletcher had a like-minded co-star in Nicholson, who found canny ways to keep her on her toes. Early on, he asked Fletcher what Nurse Ratched's first name was. She told him Mildred. Weeks later, in a group therapy scene, he surprised her with the line, I'm proud to join the group, Mildred. Fletcher can still see herself blushing in the shot. During another scene, as Nurse Ratched is locking up and leaving for the day, Nicholson yelled off camera, What did you accomplish today? Fletcher had to stifle a laugh. Still, something inside of Fletcher was itching to let loose, to show the guys she wasn't the virginal killjoy she was playing. She was suffocating, she says, in this hairdo, this dress, and everything I had on under it that I wore to be the way she was, the white stockings and the undergarments. One day she shocked herself and everyone else on set by stripping off her nurse's uniform to reveal a slip and a bra underneath. It was like, here I am, I'm a woman, I am a woman. As a wrap gift, she gave them all a photo of herself topless, peeking over her naked back, Betty Grable style, in her nurse's cap. The first time Fletcher saw the movie was in Oakland. On the way home, her agent told her, Well, it's not going to hurt you. Soon after, at a screening in Chicago, she realized the movie had hit a nerve. During the climactic scene in which McMurphy strangles Nurse Ratched, audience members stood up and yelled, Kill her! It was a sign, perhaps, of the movie's fraught gender dynamics, but also of its potency. Fletcher was thrilled. When spectators swarmed her after the credits rolled, she says, "That was the first time in my life that I had experienced what fame is." Her instinct was right. After being passed on by every studio but United Artists, Cuckoo's Nest opened on November 19, 1975, and sailed past the $100 million mark, second only to Jaws at the 1975 box office. The Academy Award nominations came out 3 months later, and Cuckoo's Nest led the field in 9 categories, including an unusually strong Best Picture race that also included Jaws, Barry Lyndon, Dog Day Afternoon, and Nashville. Fletcher was nominated for Best Actress, but thankfully she didn't have to compete with Lily Tomlin, who had been nominated for Best Supporting Actress for the role that Fletcher helped create. On March 29th, she arrived at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion looking decidedly un-Ratched-like in a flowing chiffon dress she had spotted at Bergdorf Goodman. She didn't think she would win. Her money was on Glenda Jackson for Hedda. But when Charles Bronson called her name, she bounded on stage in a whirl of chiffon. "All I can say is I've loved being hated by you," she told the Academy. Using sign language, she said to her parents, "You are seeing my dream come true." Before Cuckoo's Nest, Fletcher had been rejected by 15 agencies, but now the offers were rolling in. For reasons she can't quite recall, she turned down the part of the deranged mother in Carrie, which became a star-making role for Piper Laurie. Soon other roles, Norma Rae among them, slipped out of her grasp. In 1987, playing the evil grandmother in Flowers in the Attic, she realized just how good she'd had it with Cuckoo's Nest, when the director, Jeffrey Bloom, instructed her, "Scare me to death." "The director didn't understand about villains," she says. "What's so familiar can be the most frightening thing." As for Nurse Ratched, Fletcher isn't one for revisionism. "She's one of the great heavies," she says proudly, adding, "If you have women like that in authority, you have reason to be afraid." When I ask if Nurse Ratched has any redeeming qualities, she smiles. "Well, she saw that your teeth were clean." She sips some tea and continues, "Control is one of the most terrible issues, isn't it? Some people just have to have total control, or they can't be in this world." During the 2016 presidential race, memes sprouted up online of Hillary Clinton as Nurse Ratched. When I show one to Fletcher, she cackles and says, "She's got my hair all right." Much as Cuckoo's Nest encapsulates its era, in which the psychedelic party had soured and the man was wresting back control, you can't help but see its echoes in our own America gone mad. After all, isn't Donald Trump a kind of McMurphy, fueled by impulse, chaos, and testosterone, able to rally a disaffected populace? Now that we're living in McMurphy's world, President Ratched doesn't sound much worse. At least our teeth would be clean. Now, on books. Two new books go in search of the real Lolita, by Sarah Weinman. It is strange, Vladimir Nabokov once wrote, the morbid inclination we have to derive satisfaction from the fact, generally false and always irrelevant, that a work of art is traceable to a true story. These words are lifted from his 1944 study of Russian master Nikolai Gogol, but they would not be out of place in Nabokov's own autobiography, Speak, Memory. The author's lifelong mission was the pursuit of his art, and those who dared question him about the real-life inspirations and meanings of his fiction soon realized their mistake. Yet, in Nabokov's Lolita, the much-vaunted and still controversial novel of a European gentleman's illicit relationship with a 12-year-old American girl, celebrating the 60th anniversary of its American publication this August, one line thrums with the overtones of corporeal inspiration. It's toward the end of the book, when Humbert Humbert returns to the town where his ugly desires first intertwined with the unwitting and unwilling Dolores Hayes, and muses, had I done to Dolly, perhaps, what Frank LaSalle, 50-year-old mechanic, did to 11-year-old Sally Horner? And in a photo, here, Florence Sally Horner, photographed by her captor, Frank LaSalle, 1948. Nabokov began writing Lolita before he ever knew a Florence Sally Horner, an 11-year-old who was kidnapped from Camden, New Jersey, in the summer of 1948. He'd spent decades working through different fictive versions of a middle-aged man's unholy sexual desire for a young girl, from Laughter in the Dark, first published in 1932, to The Gift, 1952, to the posthumously published novella The Enchanter, originally written in 1939 and widely viewed as the precursor to Lolita. But it's likely that learning of Sally's 21-month nightmare, during which she was kidnapped, perpetually assaulted, and driven cross-country from New Jersey to San Jose, California, provided Nabokov with the necessary framework and impetus to finish the work. Knowing one source of inspiration for Lolita does not diminish its success. The book is packed with countless other references, historical, literary, and meta, and if anything, its brilliance grows with each rereading. But when, in 2013, I realized that the story of Sally Horner's kidnapping had never been fully reported, I decided to do so in parallel to Nabokov's fictionalization. There is a necessary translation that occurs when one portrays, in writing, the life of a real human being. The Sally Horner who has lived in my head for the past 4 years, as I worked on what would become the real Lolita, the kidnapping of Sally Horner, and the novel that scandalized the world, out in September from Echo, is not the Sally Horner who was a daughter, a sister, an aunt, a friend, and a kidnapping victim. That Sally died almost 30 years before I was born. Breathing life back into a voluminous and fragmented collection of documents, interviews, and extensive research has prompted a question that anyone incorporating life into art must grapple with. Is my Sally Horner the most true and honest version? An unwitting complication arrived thanks to Rust and Stardust, published by St. Martin's, T. Greenwood's novel about Sally's ordeal out in August. Greenwood read a 2014 article I had written for Hazlitt on Sally Horner, which formed the germ of my own book, and extrapolated a fictional universe for Sally, Frank, and others in their orbit, characters both real and imagined. Novelists should be free to write whatever they want, to let their imaginations roam as close to or as removed from reality as they see fit. Artists, in theory, should not be limited to their personal experience, culture, identity, and worldview, but they must also accept that the degree of difficulty in imagining beyond their own borders is steep, and the failure rate is high. What differentiates Dana Schutz, the white artist who was largely derided for her 2016 painting of Emmett Till's open casket, from the French-Moroccan author Leila Slimani, who drew inspiration for her much-lauded recent novel, The Perfect Nanny, from the 2012 murder of two New York children by their babysitter, or from Nabokov, a male author who depicted repeated rapes of a young girl. Based, we now know at least partially, on a real girl's personal horror, some may argue that the difference lies in the artist's identity, and others that it is simply a question of execution. The artistic aims and product have to validate what might otherwise fall flat as mere appropriation. When a novel is based on an actual crime, it should do much more than loosely fictionalize it. The novel must stand alone as a work of art that justifies using the story for its own purposes. Emma Klein's 2016 debut novel, The Girls, is based on the 1969 Manson murders, but what makes the book sing is its exploration of the insidious nature of patriarchy, where hero worship among young women is played out against the orbit of impressing an older man. Emma Flint's Little Deaths, published the following year, fictionalizes the mid-1960s story of Alice Crimmins, a mother convicted of murdering her two small children, and likewise transcends its origin story. The focal point is a woman's struggle to assert her independence and freedom when society at large dared to judge her for living an unconventional life. In writing Rust and Stardust, Greenwood, the author of 11 previous novels, several of which center on the death of a child, has given herself a monumental challenge. She is inviting comparison not only to a historical crime, but also to what is largely considered one of the greatest works of American literature. Readers without extensive knowledge of the case, nor of Nabokov's Lolita, will likely meet a thoughtfully rendered, if clunkily written, version of Sally, whose ordeal is shown for the proper horror that it was, rather than exploited for entertainment. In the end, authority, with respect to art and storytelling, is never exclusive. The whole truth of Sally Horner is outside the bounds of memory and research and imagination. So, too, is her immortality. Now here's the August 2018 cover story, Kendrick Ascendant, on tour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning King of Rap by Lisa Robinson, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, Kendrick Lamar, photographed on stage at Jones Beach Theater in Wantagh, New York, May 30th. Toni Morrison said, Kendrick Lamar understands and employs blues, jazz, and soul in his music, which makes it startling. His work is more than merely brilliant. It is magic. Chuck D said, it takes guts, courage, and skill to shoulder the burden of a generation's mindset. Culturally, Kendrick Lamar is that compass, in fact, a GPS. In this current hour of chaos, that enough is worth a Pulitzer Prize or any award that sets the bar high. LeBron James said, I love everything about his music. I can literally listen to his music and become a kid growing up with all the struggles in the inner city, but at the same time learn all the lessons it taught that we use as men today. If you listen to the last verse of Black Boy Fly on Good Kid, Mad City, I know exactly what he means, because I was that kid. Kendrick Lamar said, the minute I hear good news, it just motivates me to do more. I don't want to get complacent. If you ask 7 out of 10 people, what would you do if you got the Pulitzer Prize? They'd say, I'd put my feet up. But that would make me feel I'd reached my pinnacle at 30 years old, and that wouldn't make me feel good. Memorial Day, Peter Luger Steakhouse, Brooklyn. Kendrick Lamar orders salmon. He is wearing a black baseball cap, white t-shirt, and gray and blue pants, and I'm seated to his right at an upstairs table for 10. To my right is Kendrick's TDE, Top Dog Entertainment, label mate, rapper, and friend, J-Rock. And the rest of our lunch party is comprised of friends and associates of Kendrick's. Dave Free, his friend since 9th grade, manager, co-director of their groundbreaking videos, and TDE president. Dave's assistant, Keaton Smith, Kendrick's assistant, Derek McCall, photographer, videographer, Chris Parsons, head of TDE security, 2Ts, TDE general manager, Rhett One, and publicist, Ray Alba. Except for Kendrick's fish choice, everyone else orders cheeseburgers and steak, medium rare. Platters of French fries and creamed spinach are brought to the table. Despite people sitting at tables all around us, we are left alone. Kendrick, who has a reputation as enigmatic and shy, warms up as we talk about music, basketball, government, taxes, other rappers, and awards. I tell them that LeBron James wore a TDE t-shirt at practice the day before, prior to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. We talk about Madison Square Garden, where the following night, Kendrick will perform his first sold-out headlining show at the world's most famous arena as part of the 30-date TDE Championship Tour with a lineup of the label's artist. We talk about the changes in Harlem, the changes in Brooklyn, and how New York is no longer the city that never sleeps. There is a wide-ranging conversation about the music Kendrick grew up listening to in Compton, California, The Temptations. He was named for lead singer Eddie Kendricks. Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye, Michael Jackson, and gangsta rap. And I answer queries about my interviews of yesteryear. I tell Kendrick to forget about the 3 times he was nominated for the Best Album Grammy and didn't win, although I didn't say it quite so politely, and congratulate him on winning the Pulitzer Prize, the first for a non-classical or non-jazz musician, and the first for a rapper. Kendrick always appears to be thinking or listening until he breaks into a gap-toothed grin or a laugh. These guys know each other well, especially Dave and Kendrick, who finish each other's sentences and the vernacular is unfiltered, rooted in hip-hop and the streets of Compton. Following lunch, we all get into a Mercedes Sprinter, stopping at a pop-up store on Hudson Street in Manhattan that sells a clothing collaboration between TDE and Nike, with whom Kendrick also has a shoe deal. Then we head uptown to an East Side hotel, where he and I sit and talk for over an hour. In addition to winning this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music, Kendrick Lamar has sold more than 17.8 million albums, been nominated for 29 Grammys, and won 12. His work is archived in the library at Harvard University. He's been described as the poet laureate of hip-hop, perceptive, philosophical, unapologetic, fearless, and an innovative storyteller whose body of work has been compared to James Joyce and James Baldwin. He's collaborated with, among many others, Jay-Z, Eminem, Dr. Dre, Beyoncé, Rihanna, Bono, Pharrell Williams, J-Rock, and Maroon 5. He writes about being young, black, poor, and gifted in America with a candid self-awareness of who he is, where he's from, and where he's been. Musician-producer Pharrell, who worked with Kendrick on the songs Good Kid and All Right, had told me he's the Bob Dylan, the Miles Davis of our time. But he's his own thing. His ability to entertain while educating without ever being preachy is amazing. I ask Kendrick how he balances his enormous success and celebrity with his extreme work ethic. You can get put in an environment that can bring down your integrity and your fight, he says. What gives me an advantage in my upbringing is the duality of seeing one of the most beautiful moments of me being 6 years old to the most tragic moment of being 13 or 14, and make that connection so the person listening can really see the conflict. It was a mind F for sure. I would wake up one morning, and it would be cartoons and cereal and walking back from school. And at 4 p.m., we'd be having a house party till 11 p.m., and people were shooting each other outside the door. That was my lifestyle. And it's not only mine, it's so many other individuals. And I wanted to tell that story. Eminem said, "By the end of listening to his first full album, I felt like I knew everything about him. He brings you into his world with his lyrics in a way that really paints a clear picture." Among other individuals to whom his story resonates are the NBA basketball players who grew up either in Compton or similar Los Angeles neighborhoods. According to Orlando Magic forward Aaron Aflalo, name-checked in Kendrick's song, "Black Boy Fly," "I used to be jealous of Aaron Aflalo. If you're in Compton with all that negativity and violence, and you know you have the talent that Kendrick obviously has, and you watch someone that's successful, I don't think jealous is a negative word. It's something that made him hungry. He knew what he could become." Next photo, Lamar in a 1985 Buick LeSabre outside the New York Expo Center in the Bronx. Toronto Raptors all-star DeMar DeRozan, who grew up near Kendrick, says, "Everything he raps about is what we had to overcome and grow through." And Oklahoma City Thunder all-star point guard Russell Westbrook adds, "He grew up in the same neighborhoods I grew up in, and to see him be able to explain the struggles of his upbringing through his music is inspirational. He's opening people's eyes to what people go through in the inner city." Bono said, "For a gentle dude, he throws a righteous punch. I wouldn't get in the way of it. No single artist will ever be the antidote to a generation's malaise, but just identifying some of the problems really helps." Kendrick Lamar Duckworth was born in Compton 31 years ago to Paula Oliver and Kenny Duckworth, and is the oldest of four siblings. He started freestyling around the age of 8, when he tells me he mostly rapped about drugs. but by the time he was 16, under the name K-Dot, his closest friends still call him Dot, he got serious about music. I was recording in Dave Free's garage, he tells me, and Dave said he had to get my music to Top, Anthony Top Dog Tiffith, who was getting into the music business. The first day in the vocal booth, Top said, "Let me see if this is really you," and I was just freestyling, rapping whatever came into my head, sweating for 2 hours. Dave Free said, "The first time I ever heard him rap, I had to listen back because it was so developed, super complex, and I just couldn't believe it since he was so young." After Kendrick's early EPs and mixtapes, Dave told him that it was time for him to drop the K-Dot and use his real name. And Top, now the head of TDE, who described himself then as a local street dude who was trying to change his life for the better, adds, "What impressed me was how advanced Kendrick was at 16 years old. He spoke from an adult perspective every time he touched the mic." Over the course of 15 years, I've watched him evolve from a kid on the corner breaking down street tales to a creative genius breaking down cultural barriers. Kendrick tells me that most of the kids he knew from elementary school are either dead or in jail. But, he says, he was more grounded because he had a mother and a father in the home. "It makes a huge difference," he says. "It shows you loyalty. When I look around at my classmates and my friends, they all lived with their grandparents. To have a mother and a father in your household, this showed me immediately that anything is possible." On his major label debut, Good Kid, Mad City, both his parents are heard on answering machine tapes, and their language is tough, uninhibited. His mother, after yelling at him to bring back her van, then turns tender and says, "I love you, Kendrick," and tells him to take this music thing seriously, be a positive person, and come back and tell your stories to your city. She adds that his music better be something that she and his father can step to, because we're from Chicago and that's what we do. Kendrick tells me his parents were young when they left Chicago, with just $500 and wound up in a Compton hotel. Mom had to go to McDonald's to get hired there. My father had to find friends, and it was a whole gang culture. They were learning, and they did the best they could do as far as protecting me. But they loved to indulge in that fast lifestyle, the partying and everything that comes with it. My mother encouraged me to dream. She was very proud of my efforts. My third grade teacher came up to my mother once at a parent-teacher meeting, and she said, "Your son used a word that I was totally amazed by. He said audacity." Even then, it gave me an advantage in life to be able to take information, listen to it, and take a perspective without judging it and do my own research. The duality was that my father was more like, "Okay, good, now do it again." There never was a super embrace, and it gave me an understanding of being critiqued, almost like, "I know you can do it better, so I'm not going to show you how great you are already." It was a manipulation that worked in my favor later in life. By the time I was being critiqued, there was nothing you could tell me because I know it's not my best anyway. I ask if growing up he had read a lot of books. "I read the dictionary," he said. We talk about the violence he sings and raps about in Good Kid, Mad City. And Kendrick says, "That was our world. I remember when Good Kid came out, the people I grew up with couldn't understand how we made that translate through music. They literally cried tears of joy when they listened to it. Because these are people who have been shunned out of society. But I know the kinds of hearts they have. They're great individuals. And for me to tell my story, which is their story as well, they feel that someone has compassion for us. Someone does see us further than just killers or drug dealers. We were just kids." I ask about the line that implies he shot someone at 16, and he just looks at me, smiles, and eventually says, "I'll put it this way, I've seen my own blood shed, and I've been the cause of other people shedding their blood as well." There was a split second when I felt what my homeboys were feeling, like I don't give an F anymore, and that's when I knew something else had to happen. Among the something else in his life, two baptisms, the first at 16, and again in my 20s, just for that reassurance and belief in God. Paul Rosenberg, Eminem's manager and the chairman and CEO of Def Jam Records, was the first to bring Kendrick's music to Dr. Dre, who signed him to his Aftermath label in a joint deal with TDE. "Kendrick is an extremely prolific and cerebral rapper," says Rosenberg. "Every word is so well placed, so thought out, so meaningful. There's no dead space." And Dr. Dre told me, "The thing that turned me on the most was when I watched a video of him talking about his music and the passion he had in his voice about the art. You just knew this guy was destined for greatness." Producer Rick Rubin says, "Kendrick is one of the best of all time, making modern and challenging new music." He adds, "He exists on another plane." In addition to Kendrick's extraordinary talent as a writer, rapper, and producer, he has an ear for melody and an ability to assume different voices on his songs, which he tells me he got from listening to Prince and the music he heard at his parents' house parties. He also packs so many words and syllables into one bar of a song without ever stopping for breath. And through his music, he's taken on the role of spokesman for a neighborhood that goes way beyond Compton. I ask him, "Why you?" "I put that responsibility on myself. I knew from jump that I thought a little bit different. People respected me, and if I let myself down, I'd be letting my guys down." Fast forward to 2018. I'm in a position where these guys have 10, 15, 20 years in prison. But I can go in there, and I do, and tell them that when they get out, you have a job. And my word stands. I ask him about the guns in his Piru, also known as Bloods, neighborhood in Compton, and he says, "I have compassion for and more understanding rather than frustration with my homies, because I know it's not 100% their fault. When I look at how society has shaped our communities, it's been generations passed down of putting people in cages to battle each other." He talks about the survivor's guilt that is a recurring theme in his songs and says, "I had 3 or 4 years of success and celebrity, but I can't get rid of the 20 years of being with my homies and knowing what they go through. I can't throw that away. I know a lot of people who could. I've seen it, like, F you, I've got money now. I'm out of here. I don't give an F about none of y'all. But that was something I couldn't deal with. I had to sit back and analyze it and figure out other ways I could impact these people without physically trying to bring the whole hood inside a hotel." During a solo set at the Hangout Festival in Alabama this past May, Kendrick brought a white female fan on stage to sing Mad City with him, as he's done at many of his concerts. White people usually know to move the mic away from their mouths when it gets to the parts with the N-word. She didn't, and he stopped the show and called her on it. He and I discussed the ubiquitous use of that word in rap, with the A at the end of it, and the implicit understanding of who can say it and who cannot. I mentioned that many rappers have told me that they feel they have appropriated that word and taken it back. But Oprah once told Jay-Z in an interview that when she hears it, even with an A at the end of it, she thinks of a lynching. Kendrick is thoughtful for a long minute. Then he says, "Let me put it to you in its simplest form. I've been on this earth for 30 years, and there's been so many things a Caucasian person said I couldn't do. Get good credit. Buy a house in an urban city. So many things. You can't do that. whether it's from afar or close up. So if I say this is my word, let me have this one word. Please let me have that word. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.